Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. I welcome today's live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce our panel discussion tonight on Caesar Maximus. Caesar Maximus is an adaptation of Julius Caesar by Shakespeare, the play, by We Players, an organization here in San Francisco that puts on plays in public spaces. It's really quite an amazing thing that they've been doing for many years now, but this is their latest version. And we have Richard Levin, Professor Richard Levin. He's Professor Emeritus at UC Davis, and he is a Shakespeare scholar. He's the author of Shakespeare's Secret Schemers. We have Matt Davis, who's a Latin teacher at Miramonte High School and well-versed in the classics, who also went to UC Davis, by the way. And we have Ava Roy, the artistic director of We Players. And we have Nick Medina, the adapter of Julius Caesar into the new play, Caesar Maximus. So,
right. Okay.
Ava?
Yes.
Take it away.
Okay. Sure. Hi, everybody. People in the room. People, invisible people listening, if you're listening out there in the world. My name is Ava Roy. I'm the artistic director of We Players. And We Players is a San Francisco-based theater company, but it's rather special, unusual theater, as the audience is on their feet following the show as it moves throughout a location. And we work primarily with the National Park Service, as well as California State Parks and municipal parks as well. So a lot of the sort of fundamental mission of our work is to get people exploring the gems of their local landscape, getting to know their own backyard, their own front yard, their own city, and not only going to those places, but learning more about them, coming to appreciate them more, and hopefully through the way that we stage our productions, which I'll speak a little bit more to, that our audiences have a heightened sense of place and self and interaction, because things are happening all around you, above you, below you, in the distance, on the rooftop, et cetera, et cetera. And because it's this kind of multidimensional stage, sphere of performance, if you will, we're able to stage things and activate things that are either backstory in or happen offstage in the wings when there's an offstage and you're in a theater space, or things that are hinted at in the text in the play that we can activate. So the hope and the intention is that the audience will really feel immersed into this world, and that it's not a play being performed in front of them, but it's a world that they're entering into and participating in. And one of the great joys of doing that is we get to work in these incredible historic buildings and landscapes that add so much to the production. So the space is not just a backdrop, but the space becomes another character, the other director. We are humbled by the elements and the sheer forces of nature, and we get both ends of that spectrum. We get these ferocious winds sometimes when we're performing on Alcatraz, where we did Hamlet some years ago, in the fog and the mist and the cold, but we also get these incredible gifts from nature when the full moon rises behind Macduff and Macbeth as they battle to their death on the roof of the fortress under the Golden Gate Bridge, Fort Point, or when a flock of pelicans goes by, or a whale breaches off stage at Sutro Baths when we were staging Undine there some years ago. So that's a little bit of context, and I can speak a little bit more to that and take questions later about the work and some of the philosophy and methodology driving the creation of We Players art. But tonight, we're here to talk about Caesar Maximus, which is our next upcoming production. Nick and I just came from rehearsal moments ago where we were staging the assassination. Very exciting stuff. Excuse me. And I think for the moment, I just want to give a little bit of context for the production and then let my fellows here speak, and then we can kind of talk a little bit more about different aspects of the production and how it collides with these different layers of history. So I think that's actually a good place to start, the layers of history. That initially I got interested in this play when I was visiting Federal Hall on Wall Street in New York City. And at first thought, well, this play that went from not being on my list of plays to really do went skyrocketing to the top because of that confluence of thematic connection to the play, which I was speaking to a moment ago, that alchemical relationship between a site and a story that makes you more fully experience and appreciate and understand both. And then that just kind of led me on this Julius Caesar exploration and conversations with my colleague Nick over the past couple of years. And where we have come to is that on August 16th, we will preview and then run through September 30th our adaptation of Caesar called Caesar Maximus at the Music Concourse in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. How many people in the room know know the Music Concourse? Awesome. Great. You live here. So it's this really phenomenal space. You've got the band shell at one end and this kind of long plaza colonnade space with three fountains. And so the audience starts at a festival, right, which is how the play actually starts, the Feast of Lupercal. It's the Ides of February, actually, or something like that. And it's a festival. And so the audience will arrive and enter into this kind of interactive Roman street scene with all of the characters of our world, and then some. Some we've added or expanded their roles. And so the audience gets to interact and really be drawn into this world. And in that festival, we get to introduce a lot of the aesthetic elements that will play throughout the rest of the piece. The circus elements, because if you didn't get suspicious with the title, Caesar Maximus is inspired by Circus Maximus, and this is a circus and opera-infused adaptation of Caesar. And Nick can probably speak a little bit more to those popular art forms and how we're of the 19th century and how we're incorporating them. We have our circus, we have our opera, we have our Caesar, and we have this confluence of layers of history. So we have ancient Rome, which hopefully Matt can speak to a little bit more. And we have Elizabethan England, the time that Shakespeare was writing and the play that he actually wrote. We have the founding of the United States of America, which this democracy, and again, the interest in Federal Hall, is modeled on the Roman Republic. That's why we have words like senator and why we have civic centers that have that same Greco-Roman architecture. So how do these layers of history not confuse the picture and be unspecific, but actually complicate and enrich the picture as we try to look through all of those lenses of time? And I will end my comments for my opening comments here by saying that time has really become a driving force and motif through our adaptation of Caesar. In some way, all of Shakespeare's plays are obsessed with time and the passage of time. And it's something that's given us great insight into both the physical act that the audience engages in of moving through space and time as they move through this performance landscape, and as we move through these kind of apertures of time and the ways in which we look at ourselves through story and through history. Great. So there's some things, and hopefully, thank you. Those are some things to kind of go, this is the realm we're in. And Matt, would you tell us more about actual history?
Sure. I mean, so this is set in the first century BC. And what's happening basically is Rome has conquered the world, but in conquering the world, they're losing their democracy. They have enriched themselves with conquests all the way from Spain to Syria, bringing in massive amounts of money, slaves. And as the wealth is coming in, people are getting corrupted. Corruption is ruining the democracy. People are getting bribed. People are buying political office, and Caesar's involved in this to the max. He is really the best politician. He is the most successful politician that Rome ever created. He used the Roman democracy, the Roman system, to enrich himself, enrich his family, and to be very successful. One of the most famous stories about Caesar kind of illustrates the character of Caesar is Caesar and the Pirates. Have you heard Caesar and the Pirates? So when he was a young man of 25, he had some big problems in his life. His father died when he was 16. His family had been on the wrong side of some civil wars. And by this point, things have kind of calmed down, and he wanted to go to the east, go to the island of Rhodes to further his education, which is great. That's good. And he was going to study with the teacher who taught Cicero, the great orator. On the way there, he was taken by some pirates on a little island that you can still visit that's about 5 miles away from Turkey. The Turkish town of Bodrum, if you've ever been there, it's right close to there. And he was stuck on this island for 38 days. And when the pirates took him, they said, "Oh, who are you?" And he said, "Well, I'm Gaius Julius Caesar." And he said, "Well, I think we should get a ransom for you. Maybe 30 talents. That sounds good." And he's like, "What? 30 talents? No, that's way too little. It should be 50 at least." And they're like, "Okay, all right. Okay. Well, go send your people out to get money and come back, and then we'll let you go." And so Caesar hung out with these pirates. And if you're familiar with the writer Plutarch, who wrote many biographies, described these pirates as the most bloodthirsty pirates ever. You know, they were not nice people. And Caesar hung out with them. Did Caesar cower in fear? Did he hide under the bed, you know, while he's doing this? No, he actually hung out with them. He played games with them. He exercised with them. When they were being too loud and he was trying to sleep, he told them to be quiet. He, as you know, Caesar was a great writer and an orator. So he was writing speeches and verses, and he would read it to the pirates, and the pirates would be, "Well, that wasn't so good, Caesar." And he's like, "Oh, you're just illiterate barbarians." You know, and what did the pirates think of Caesar? Oh, they were charmed by this man. They just thought he was the funniest guy. "Oh, he's so funny." You know, they were like, they became buds almost. And then 38 days later, his friends returned with the money. They paid the pirates off. Caesar left, went to a nearby Greek town, raised the fleet, returned, and then took him out. He always threatened. While he was there, he threatened and said, "You know, guys, I'm going to come back later and crucify you all." And they're like, oh, Caesar, you're so funny. But he actually did. And then when he brought the pirates to the nearby Roman governor, and said, "You know, these guys need to be crucified because they're pirates, right?" And the governor's like, I don't know. I think I want all their money. I want all their money, you know? And the corruption was there, you know? And Caesar then took charge of it himself, went out, ordered on his own authority, even though he's 25 years old, and got the pirates executed, and then took the money of the pirates for himself. And this really illustrates his, you know, how he was in history. You know, he fought wars in Gaul. He fought the Civil War. He was charming. When I think of Caesar, I think of someone who has great charisma. People liked him in spite of themselves. His enemies loved him. His friends loved him. You know, if you went into a situation, you'd just be totally charmed by him. And then afterwards, you're like, "What did I just agree to?" You know, and he's charming. He was also highly literary. I mean, he would love Shakespeare. He would have been into plays. He went to plays. He wrote verse. He wrote his commentaries that were elegant but accessible Latin for everyone, you know. And then he was a take charge kind of guy. If he saw a situation, if he was in time of crisis, he didn't cower. He didn't hide. In the Gallic Wars, when things went poorly, he would grab a shield and lead the counterattack and save the day. And this served him well throughout life. He always knew, he always had that ability to make the right decision, the ability to be in a time of crisis, to be able to deal with the problem at hand. And that was really what's going on. There was a series of crises going on here in the Roman Empire leading up to the play. The civil wars, fighting against friends, people who he had allied with, such as Pompey, who was actually his son-in-law. You know, fighting against people that he knew. I mean, Cicero's brother served in Caesar's army. So they all were closely joined, and that's what's going on. It's kind of like almost friends fighting friends, and Caesar came out on top. Yeah.
Yeah, and vying for the top seat and doing whatever they can to maintain that position or take that position. Richard, do you want to pick this up from here and talk to us a little bit about kind of the play before Nick got his hands on it and chopped it all up and rearranged it, and sort of where we're starting from in terms of the play that Caesar wrote and this moment in time historically in Rome?
Sure. Well, I think this background that you've provided is very helpful. when we read the play, we get the sense that things are in tumult, that whatever kind of order and set of political positions have been well established, and now they've broken down, and so you can't tell where trouble is going to come. And Julius Caesar is portrayed as having come out on top, and we're not quite sure. I mean, depending on who's talking and when that person is talking, it's possible to see Caesar as personally using his charm to profit himself, to get to Gladstone and Disraeli, the exchange there when Disraeli became prime minister, and Gladstone says, Providence has prevailed. And Disraeli said, no, I got to the top of the greasy pole. So so one way of looking at Caesar is just having gotten to the top of the greasy pole. But another way of looking at it, and I don't mean this is ever settled in the play, the other way of looking at it is there's sort of chaos all around him. And he's almost he's responding to the zeitgeist, the spirit of the moment. It needs a strong leader. And so when he says in his famous speech, which is the speech that finally is almost the immediate prelude to the assassination, he says, I am as constant as the northern star. And so there are thousands of stars in the firmament, but I'm the North Pole. And you can see either that could be seen as ambition and a sense that he thinks of himself as a god, or alternately it can be seen as his understanding of the need for some kind of steadying force among all these conflicting forces. And these relatives and friends, these people are portrayed, the ruling class of the romantics, as knowing each other very, very well and having grown up together. And so on the one hand, there's a kind of equality or camaraderie, and the idealized sense of Rome is like of a band of brothers. But in fact, there's all these tension. It takes the form of envy. As Caesar gets higher and higher up, people around him say, but I saw him faint once or almost drown, and I helped him in a crisis and so on. Like, they're beside themselves with Caesar's success. And when we see Caesar, it's after this illustrious earlier youthful career, but some of the old charm and panache is there, and he's able to be jovial, and he's also very shrewd in his assessment, particularly of Cassius. And also you can see a kind of a charm in Antony, something that in Caesar, that's something that sets him apart from the others, is his genuine appreciation of Mark Antony. And I think in light of this play and in Shakespeare's later Antony and Cleopatra, I think Shakespeare was highly partial to Mark Antony. It doesn't mean he idolizes him. Shakespeare gives everyone heinous faults, but on the whole, and Caesar in a way relives his youthful self through Antony and sees the two bond in a way that suggests that moves outside of all this political self-aggrandizement. There's genuine friendship involved, and there isn't much of that. There's not much of that in the play. So to sum up, then, so what's going to happen in this situation that's in so fluid and so uncertain? Who's going to prevail, and you don't fully understand what's happened when the assassination takes place, because forces are set in motion. As soon as the assassination takes place, there's utter confusion among the conspirators. They don't know what in the devil, they don't know really what's happening. And so there isn't as if a new leader or a new political class has emerged. There's complete uncertainty. So another way of saying this is all the characters in the play are puzzles to us. Shakespeare, he seems like the final eulogy for Antony's eulogy for Brutus. It's extremely unlikely, in my opinion, that Mark Antony really praises Brutus because he's been a very sharp and critical observer of Brutus all along. So that would be, so is Brutus really the noblest Roman of the oral? And you can ask the same question about all the other major characters. What do we think of them in light of the needs of the moment and in light of the past that they've come out of and so on? They're complex and things we can be divided over. Shakespeare doesn't make it so that we all are going to agree on the virtues and faults of various characters or where things are likely to turn at the end of the play.
Yeah, that's really interesting because just to hear you say that and remind me of some of those things, because this play, more than any other Shakespeare play, at least that I'm familiar with, is the most historically accurate, both to the events and the order in which they happened, whereas in other historical plays or other plays, he's taking a bit of history and then wildly extrapolating and using his genius to invent and so on. But also, not only the events of the play, but also the characters are the most historically accurate like their historical counterparts, which is, you know, you reference Plutarch's Lives, and it's Plutarch, you know, wrote these biographies about all the famous Romans of the time. So Plutarch has an essay on pretty much each of these characters, and they're really incredible to read because there's this, again, about time. Suddenly there's this time shrinks, and there's this direct connection to the bard because he read Plutarch, and that's where he got the information from. And it's kind of this wild moment to be like, oh yeah, Antony's carousing, and Shakespeare didn't invent that. He read it, you know, in Plutarch, and the way that the characters. And I think that for me, that connects to what you're saying about there isn't a hero, there isn't a Hamlet, there isn't a Macbeth, you know, the one person that we're really kind of following his. We're trying to follow all of these different threads, which is so much more like life, right? We're all the heroes and the villains, depending on what part of the story or what vantage you're looking at it from. Maybe, Nick, you can take it from here.
I think that's part of why I really was drawn to this play initially, is the fact that there is no central character. Julius Caesar dies in the third act pretty early on. The tragedy doesn't start until he's dead. So it's, well, then who is the main character? What's going on? And slowly started to realize that this is about social forces. This is about groups of elites jockeying with power with each other, and it's about the citizenry, the urban poor, who, in Shakespeare's telling of it at least, are very closely linked to Caesar and closely linked to Antony through Caesar. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite partial to Antony myself as well. So for me, the climax of the play is Antony giving this speech where at the beginning they're ready to tear him apart for being a friend of Caesar after Brutus has convinced them that Caesar was a tyrant. And by the end, he's whipped them into such a terrible fury that they go and they murder someone just because they had the name of a conspirator. They tear this gentle poet limb from limb in this grotesque clown scene. And for us, I think we thought that's the climax of the play. That's it there. And that so encapsulates a cycle that we go through in our own society and in Elizabethan England as well, because festivals in Elizabethan England, just like they did in the Roman era, often turned into bloody riots. And in 1599, Queen Elizabeth survived multiple assassination attempts. So Shakespeare was very much writing about the urban violence, the urban unrest, and the elite jockeying for power in his own situation. And of course, it's only too easy to think about it in our times, as we have a riot right now happening in south side of Chicago. And we have all sorts of talk of cloak and daggery. But I didn't want to set it in the present day because that's too on the nose, and it's not quite right either. So looking back at this, the machine politics, essentially, like you were saying, the glad-handing, the fact that he builds it up, and I said the 19th century, which happens to be my century, I'm just so fascinated with it, but the 19th century is a nice little synecdoche for Elizabethan England and Rome in 44 BC and our own time, because you have these intensely rich industrialists who control, say, New York politics or San Francisco politics, and then you have this class of urban laboring class that is conscious of itself and is ready to turn violent when it is motivated in the right way. And often, just like in the play, that violence is not against the elites, who they maybe should be in conflict with, but against each other and themselves. So in this city, in the 1870s, Kearney, who was a terrible demagogue, who came through and jostled the white and the Irish workers against the Chinese, when, in fact, you know, there are problems with the city government. And so that, for me, was the reason that I was excited about this play, and the reason that I really structured it as the climax being Antony and then the death of Cinna, the poet, this innocent. But as we've been working on it, all these other little things, you start to go, oh, yes, well, Brutus and Cassius are important too, aren't they? They're characters as well. And so a new frame started to present itself. And I'm interested in what you said earlier about the motivations of the various characters for why they kill Caesar. For Cassius, it's envy. It's a personal spite, because Cassius now, if Caesar carelessly but not on him, must bend his body like a wretched creature. Brutus, meanwhile, it's always honor, honor for the good of Rome. He's the soul of Rome. He's doing it because his great-grandfather's dead. But I remember there was a Shakespeare character that asked, what is honor? A word. And in the very first scene of the play, Cassius and Brutus, Cassius says, let me be your glass, let me be your mirror, let me show you the shadow that you don't want to see for yourself. And so we started to think about them in terms of this relationship between shadow and light, that maybe Brutus's reasons are also not as high-minded as he says, and that in fact Cassius is just a representation of the things that Brutus wants, in the same way that eventually the citizenry release their shadow selves and destroy Cinna the poet in an act of sacrifice. So these shadow imageries that the play is about, the shadow slowly catching up to Brutus. And so the last act of our play, which has been sliced down from two full Shakespearean acts to just one scene. And it takes place in this terrible tunnel that, when we rehearse, children are afraid to go into it. It's such a disturbing tunnel. But in the tunnel, it's like we're already in hell, that Brutus is already at the ninth or the seventh circle where he hangs out with Judas. But that he's already dead, and that from the back, silhouetted, is Cassius, slowly coming to confront him with the darkness within himself. So you make discoveries, and that all that stuff only just came in last week. So I'm curious to see what it'll be like by the end of the play.
We're going to keep making incredible discoveries, and we hope you'll all come see it, come share in it with us. I'm sure that we can now go back and forth and back and forth amongst us all, but perhaps some of these people have questions that will guide how our discussion forward.
Great. I'd like to remind our audience online and on the radio that they're listening to a panel discussion of Caesar Maximus, a play that will be starting in August in Golden Gate Park, and it's being put on by We Players. So we have a panel discussion going on at the Commonwealth Club. And anybody can ask a question and engage any of the panelists, or all of them.
So I'm curious about opera and the circus, you know, because these seem to be forms that are from different sectors of society and how they intersect in this staging.
Mm-hmm. Setting it in the 19th century, or setting it into some time in the 19th century, at the dawn of recorded music, which actually works for us because we're in a... The music concourse was built in 19, was finished in the 1917.
19,
sometime in the teens. The two most popular forms of recorded music were Caruso recordings, opera, and then Sousa marches. And of course, Sousa marches, I don't know if you can listen to them and not hear.
Circus.
Circus music. The circus is also a quintessentially American art form. They took it from the British, like so many things, but really made it their own. And we picked it at first because it seemed like to fit the period. But we slowly started to build in, well, what is a circus made of? It's made of three things. It's made of clowns. We got plenty of those. It's a Shakespeare play. There's always five or ten of them in a Shakespeare play, including Caesar himself is a sort of clown, at times a buffon. You have people doing acts of strength or agility, tightrope walkers, etc. Well, what are Cassius and Brutus doing but a tightrope walk? What is Antony but a lion tamer whipping the crowd into shape? And we also have a juggler, and he can do all sorts of fantastic things. And then there are animals. There's a menagerie. And, of course, we couldn't get them to let us have a horse this time. So animal imagery, and each actor, each character has their own animal. The characters often in these poetic interstitials morphing into animals. And we're very interested in how animals are a way that humans experience their shadow self, their darker side, as we've been talking about before. So that's a little bit of our thinking behind circus.
There's also the layers of just the political circus, and that, again, as we said before, that the play begins with this festival, so it's already full of color and pageantry and performance and all of that. And one thing that was really curious that our costume designer pointed out as she was doing the research, because we were looking at sort of the Civil War as the nearest war to this kind of time period for inspiration, and then the circus research, and it was pretty amazing to see them side by side, and actually the incredible aesthetic parallels between the two. These double rows of brass buttons, these, you know, of course the circus one is much more red and white striped than kind of boiled blue wool, but there's, go look at some pictures, it's pretty amazing. So I think that also speaks to what Nick was also just a moment ago talking about, of that starting with an idea that makes sense for a certain set of reasons as the doorway in or the window in, and then through the creative process with these other 15 creatives, actors, our music director, we have all live music that's original scores composed for the shows, that it's emergent and that we get to sort of be along for the ride. And based on what different actors and different performers are bringing, that Nick and I get to sort of respond to that and be moved in directions that are so much more surprising and rich than we could necessarily think up on our own. So that's been really exciting to see the ways it's unfolding further.
Well, Nick, if you were going to have a play for animals to perform, would they find their shadow selves by pretending to be humans?
Oh, absolutely. Because the terrible things that the humans do in the play, animals would never do.
This is not a political question. I just was curious to know if there are any female primary or secondary roles that move the story along.
Oh, 100%. Caesar is a woman, so yes. And we tend to be pretty, with we players, tend to be pretty just interested in actors. So sometimes we've had women play male, traditionally male roles, just as the character. Our Hamlet on Alcatraz was a woman, just playing Hamlet as a human being. And then other times we've made the choice to have a woman play a traditionally male role, but very decidedly play it as a woman. And that's the case with our Caesar.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
This question is perhaps for the professor. In this play, the crowd seems to be very irrational and very easily manipulated. You know, bending one way after Brutus' speech, and then another after Antony's. Is that intended to be a commentary by Shakespeare of either the crowds being easily manipulated, or the power of oratory? Or neither is just what happened.
Well, I like the way the alternatives that you leave us with. There was a school of thought, probably from the 19th century and the British social system. There was criticism for a long period of time how Shakespeare agreed with the characters in his play who smelled the breath of they ate a lot of garlic, so the bad breath of the lower orders of people, but then as you sort of move around, you see, like I was saying, with all the characters, same is true of the crowds as well. They can be manipulated and do ugly things. They can also be swayed. They're responsive to Mark Antony, and the danger point that they reach is shared by the aristocratic classes themselves. So it isn't unique to the mob behavior. Isn't unique to mobs. So Shakespeare's view of the lower orders as opposed to the higher orders is extremely interesting. I mean, if you take a character like Falstaff, he's Sir John Falstaff. He's benighted. He has some social stature, but he's also king of the tavern. And so Shakespeare gives his principal spokesman for the tavern, for the people. He takes it as a man who's not actually from the lower orders himself. So Shakespeare, as we might expect, doesn't simplify the situation. He has the situation to work with here that the Antony, this mob does very ugly things and is very susceptible to persuasion. But as you say, the Renaissance is extremely interested in the power of rhetoric. And if you study Brutus's speech versus Mark Antony's speech in the funeral, addressing the funeral, you know, you see two very slick rhetoricians, but Mark Antony is the superior one. Maybe because he has real heart there, more, he has a better heart.
But I mean, I think if you also look at the what's really going on in Rome here, the mob is very fickle. All these people have come into Rome over 100 years with the expansion of the empire. All these people from the outside who have lost their lands, wealth is coming in. Slaves are going out into the countryside, displacing people. They're coming in. They're looking to these politicians for food, for their jobs, and they're very fickle, and they're easily swayed. Mm-hmm. You know, the upper classes spent years and years of study. That was the whole point of their education system, is to sway people to come over to their side. Mm-hmm. And Caesar, I mean, there's a conspiracy of Catiline in 63 BC, and the Senate was actually going one direction, and he argued the other way and convinced everyone until Cato actually came along later and then convinced them to the form to it. So they spent a lot of time with rhetoric and trying to convince the mob. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And yeah, the mob is also there to show us what we're capable of. You know, that's one of the things that Shakespeare does throughout his plays is that we all have access, you know, to that sometimes we don't have the circumstances or conditions asking us to confront what we would do in that situation. So I feel like there's a way in which they're fickle and manipulated, but they're also, you know, what's manipulation? It's playing on what's already there for people, and people are agitated and hungry and desperate and afraid. And if Caesar goes, there's a power vacuum, and the world, the known world as we know it, changes the moment that Caesar is killed. Mm-hmm. And just to imagine what that's like for everybody in the room, for the senators who did it, mm-hmm. for Mark Antony who comes in and finds out that it happened, you know, that this man has become a god, and you know, for all of his strengths and weaknesses and flaws and so forth, that that everything changes in a moment, mm-hmm. and that there is this instant space for chaos to come rushing in to the void. Mm-hmm. And that's what Antony manipulates, mm-hmm. is people being out of their minds with what's going on. Mm-hmm. And and Shakespeare has them kill the poet, as Nick said, which always struck me anytime I read it or saw it, of like this play, the scene that just goes blip. It's the shortest scene in the play. It just goes by, but it's the keystone of the arch. Because after that, there is no more Roman Republic. That, you know, that's it. Then there's the Civil War, and then, you know, and then we're on to emperors. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that Shakespeare, you know, and I, well, it really, really was a poet, but the way that we are able to, just that metaphor of they kill truth and beauty, they kill the heart of the society. They kill the person who's out hawking his poems on the street corner, trying to keep the soul of a people alive through art, through the muse, through being the living body. And what else are we trying to do when we make art but try to create a space where we can reconnect with what it is to be human, that whole spectrum, that part of us that is terrible and would shred each other apart if we were desperate enough and whipped up enough, and that part of us that is, you know, trying to step into that heightened sense of self and experience. So I think the mob is really central, certainly in Nick's adaptation, and yes.
And also, I think historically what's going on here is Caesar has so dominated Roman politics. You know, Brutus and the conspirators were naive to think that the Republic would just suddenly spring back up again. And once he's dead, there's a total power vacuum. Nothing's been working really for 10, 15 years where Caesar had been manipulating, dominating, and it just wasn't working. And then he's taken control. He's a steadying hand. And then it's suddenly just gone.
And the thing that Caesar does is he sees the people. However, that's the biggest thing I think that's different. And part of why other senators are wanting to kill him is that it's very much, as Nick was speaking to earlier, everyone has these different motivations. And, you know, fundamentally, all of them are trying to preserve their elite senatorial way of life. You know, that's very important to them. And that something they don't like about Caesar, certainly something that Cassius doesn't like about Caesar, is, you know, this whole, these social programs, this doling out of the bread, that in Caesar's will, this is why Antony plays upon. You know, is it such a huge deal that you know, Antony says, oh, you know, you better not hear the will to find out how much Caesar loved you. It doesn't really matter how much those 75 drachmas mean to that people. It's, I see you, you matter, as opposed to not at all, right?
Yeah, I mean, Caesar did not grow up on the hill. He didn't grow up on the top of the Palatine Hill. He grew up down at the bottom. He grew up with the common people. You know, he was from a patrician family, but he was a popular. He was into the people. That's where he got his strength from, and that's the people he cared about. And that's where he got his power.
So. And he had just decreed a bunch of legal changes that were going to change the way Rome was going to run. I mean, it reorganized everything, like tax reform, this reform, that reform, all those reforms. And those reforms had not been put in place yet. So when he gets killed, all those promises go away too, I think, for the people. The people were expecting those reforms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Talking about mobs, and I'm very intrigued with your talking about the participatory narrative. As a director, as a writer, how do you coach the actors to think about the audience as participants in what they're doing? And how much does the audience response make a difference in what actually happens? Talk about that, would you?
Sure. Yeah, I think... Well, one thing is trying to create conditions for a conducive experience for the audience. So we're not trying to like force the audience to do anything in particular, or you don't have to start cheering and jeering during the orations with the actors, but you certainly can if you're so moved. I think the most basic level of participation is just physically following the show and moving throughout the environment and having this kind of kinesthetic experience and full sensory experience, as well as watching and listening. In different plays, I have a different answer depending on the play. You know, sometimes we've staged productions where you meet Zeus at the crossroads and you can go one of three directions, and you really do have to choose which of those three directions it's going to go, and it radically shapes your experience and you don't get to see the other two, that kind of thing. Whereas in this one, we're really more kind of moving as a group, but there are times where, you know, the audience does become the mob and is on stage and the actors are interspersed kind of through them, by osmosis, hopefully, you know, shifting that energy because of the way it's staged. The actors are not in front of you over here. They're amongst you. They're moving with you. They're part of the world. You're next to them. You have that kind of closeness. So that's kind of one of the ways that that works. In terms of, you know, training the actors, how they do that, again, it depends on what we're trying to do. With this production, we have a combination of people who are new to We Players and alums. And because it's such a different way of working, the alums definitely help support the rest of the ensemble in the kind of shifting and adjusting to kind of what works in stage inside doesn't always work outside. But I guess, you know, I guess I'd also say that that the crowd, you know, because you can choose and change your perspective, there's a degree of agency that I think is really profound for people, even if they're not stepping forward and chiming in and throwing their voice into the ring, that you have this kind of proximity and closeness. Was there another part to your question that I'm missing?
Does it change the...
Does it change the... the show? Does it change the show or the overall perspective? I think it changes the show in the way that any audience affects a show, that it's really happening right here, right now. And it's really these people and not some other people. And there are no lights, you know, making the audience kind of disappear to the actors, that you're really engaging. So on that level, it's a very direct exchange. It's a very direct conversation. But no, the audience's actions do not change the course of the play. It's very much a structured world that they are being led through and guided through. And within that structure, there's opportunity for agency. But it doesn't change, does Caesar die or not? Do we go to the tunnel or not? You know, that kind of thing. And in fact, the structure has to be really, really finely tuned and carefully coordinated, because there are so many other variables that we're dealing with, like passersby and other park visitors that were, you know, redirecting the flow of traffic or letting that influence the play or the weather, or so on and so forth. So in some ways, that kind of that clarity of structure allows us to do things both of this scale and the audience. One thing you have to do is you have to take the formation, those of you planning to come to the show, because there's no seats. You know, you're either sitting on the ground or you're sitting on one of our a folding stool behind them, or you're standing at the back, and you create this formation in new patterns depending on where the scene is, because the scene is, of course, all over the place. And one thing that's really fun about that for me when I'm hiding in the audience is that at first, the first kind of couple times, it takes a much more clear demonstration by the audience guides or the character who's who's doing that job. But the talking about mob mentality, the crowd begins to have their own kind of collective intelligence, right? And they start to take the formation and make the shape that's most organic for that space. Because after the first couple tries, when you want to make this kind of proscenium traditional setup, and you can't because of the topography or the geography, et cetera, the architecture, the audience begins to move both as individuals and as a unit. And I think that's something that's really special about this work and the audience's experience, is you have this distinct sensation that you're having your own journey, that you're seeing, that you're noticing details in the environment that maybe nobody else is, and that you're also going on this collective journey that you sort of endure together.
Yeah, obviously there's a lot of time and effort that you and thought that you put into this. So I'm curious why you happened to choose this venue with all its particular challenges. Was just a matter of the expense, and what are you going to do about, how's the acoustics, let me put it that way, and is there going to be any enhancement of the spoken word, the acoustics?
You know, it's actually, this is one of the easier spaces that we've worked in. We have a bathroom. There are food trucks. We even have a parking lot where we can park the car. But the last time I did a Wii Player show, there was a mile-long walk up a hill, and I was attacked by a rattlesnake.
You weren't attacked.
I wasn't attacked.
You
but
saw
it. It was close. It was close. So this is actually a much easier spot to work with. As to whether they are mic'd or not, we are very focused on their language. The Shakespearean speech. Was Shakespeare mic'd? Were his actors mic'd with 3,000 people stuffed into that wooden O? So, you know, some scenes are easier than others. The band shell is excellent because you can project, you know, project voice, your voice off of a stage or in the tunnel. It's fantastic because there's echoey, creepy soundscapiness. But, you know, sometimes you do just have to take that Elizabethan strategy and just speak as loudly as you can from your diaphragm.
And as an audience, yeah, you know, you get to, again, this is one of those moments of agency, is you can't hear, move, you know, get closer, adjust where you're standing. And so that's, I think, one of the ways that you are the agent of your own experience and are affecting that. Now, we have a job to do to make sure that we both tell the story as beautifully and truthfully as we can and as clearly so that you can hear the language.
Does the audience ever say, could you say that again?
Eh? That's what we do in rehearsal, eh?
Yeah.
Hi. Question about Roman history. A couple of you have referred respectively to the Roman Republic and the Empire. Right. For somebody like myself who's a neophyte, what were the connections and the transition between these two eras?
Well, so the Roman Republic was established in 510 BC after a tyrannical Roman king was kicked out. And it was basically a democracy. It was a corrupt democracy at times, but it was a democracy. They elected annual office holders. They're usually served at the same – there's usually at least two for every office. For example, the consul, the president of the Roman Republic, who led the armies and presided over the legislative assemblies and also over the Senate, there was two of them serving at one time. So you couldn't have one person seize control. Caesar was able to get around that through various means. And this went on for up till various – people say, when did the Republic die? Some people say 27 BC, some say 31. Basically, what happened is a strong man came in. Caesar came in, controlled it for a while, but then a guy named Octavian or Augustus came in, and after the death of Caesar, he became the adopted son of Caesar. He was related to Caesar. He was adopted. He came in and then was able to manipulate the soldiers who had followed Caesar into following him, and he took control of the government, defeated Mark Antony, the Battle of Actium in 31 BC, and they kept the Republic. They still call it the Republic, but then they had – you had consuls, you had praetors, you had everything going on. You still had a Senate, but then you had one person who stood above all of it, and they had various titles for that. We call him the emperor. We call him an emperor today, and he had greater power than everyone else. It was actually, say, meus imperium, greater power, and he basically set the tone for everything else. And so once Augustus had no rivals in 31 BC, historians call that the birth of the empire, which then continued on however long you want to say to Constantinople or to the fall in the West in 476 AD.
What percentage of the population were citizenry? Or free people, I suppose you.
Well,
saying.
It changed. You know, that's the problem with all this is that you know it changed. For you know, at one point, you know, I mean, like right now, I'd probably say like half.
We're
slaves, especially on the countryside. One guy we know of, a guy named Tiberius Gracchus, was going off to Spain to work there as part of a governmental thing. And while he was going through Etruria, Tuscany, and he was like lost and asking directions, and he starts talking to people, and no one spoke Latin, no one spoke Italian, no one spoke any. They were speaking Gallic, they were speaking Greek, they were speaking who knows what, because all the people in the countryside there were slaves and they were working for these large plantations there. So
they were forcibly migrated.
Oh yeah, they were forcibly migrated, and that's the thing. And even in Rome, you know, like people say the Romans, and who are the Romans? I mean, are they Italians? I don't know. They're everyone, because everyone from across the world were forced to come to Rome. There was, you know, Greeks, Spaniards, Italians, North Africans. You know, they even found, and even during the empire in England, some archaeologists dug up some people from China. They found somebody and did some DNA testing, and they realized that they were Chinese. So everyone came into the Roman Empire. So it's hard to say almost like, who are these Romans? But the basic thing, once Augustus came in 31 BC, that was when it switched over to empire.
Next question.
I have a question, and first of all, I'm incredibly excited to see this play based on everything that just the passion that everyone showed in this conversation. I cannot wait to see how it actually comes out in the music concourse. It's going to be amazing. But I have a question about both artistically and historically why this play has been chosen to be performed here in 2018. And if I think about it, I've been doing some studying on ancient Roman history and Julius Caesar in particular to kind of measure the fall of the Roman Republic and the transition into an empire, and have seen a lot of correlations between that time and today, particularly a rise of populism, a rise of propaganda fueled by that populism, leaders coming along who can say, I can take care of all of this. You don't need to worry about the norms. You don't need to worry about the way things have been done. I'm the one that's going to fix everything. I'm going to make Rome great again. sorry. But so I see a lot of correlations there, and I'm wondering if that comes into mind when you're choosing, okay, what's We Players going to do next, and then choosing Julius Caesar, what do you expect audiences today in 2018 to gather from this show, and kind of what went into choosing Julius Caesar to be shown today?
It's a prescient moment. I'll say something and then pass it to you, Nick. I think it's certainly relevant. There are lots of parallels, and they're all very interesting. But I think wide aperture, one of the things that's so great about working with Shakespeare is you can basically get at anything through Shakespeare. Right. Anything that it is to be human living in the complicated reality that it is to be a human living. So I think that one of the things that's so, you know, fantastic for us is that we can choose a play and trust that there is some reason or many layers of reasons why people are going to connect to it, partly because, again, it's just, it's all in there in Shakespeare, partly because that's what we do as humans, as meaning makers. We often conflate our reality, or we at least connect, we make connections, right? We make a connection between what we're obsessing about and thinking about and is agitating to us, and suddenly we start seeing more of that in the world. You know, there's a, I think there's a word for that, actually, that thing when you have a idea and then you start seeing it out in the world more. Is it happening more, or are you just noticing it? So Britt's saying, what is it? Confirmation bias. thank you. So that's one piece. And then I will admit that for me in choosing the play, it's all about the location. You know, I'm really in service of this conversation with a place. And actually, I realize that's the part of the question this gentleman asked a moment ago about why the music concourse. But I'm really, really interested in, you know, a place holds memory. History has happened there. Things have happened there. People have lived there. And on some level, the stones hold that memory. The space holds that memory. Each of you, you know, a place that you've had a powerful experience, that place is transformed. That place is, it looks different to you. You feel differently about that place. That's part of why we go to ancient Rome and we, our minds are blown at looking at a pile of stone because we think, wow, this pile of stone and my connection to humans across time. So I think that for, you know, for me, I really often start with either the play or the place, and then I look for what to marry with that place. So I either have the play and I'm out looking for its home, or I find a really compelling site and look for the play that's going to serve that site. And then kind of once that initial connection is made, then we can start to dig. Then we can start to dig and go, okay, yeah, ask your question now. Now we ask that question more with a greater focus. What does it mean? Nick, what does it mean?
What does it mean? I'm interested in the populism. Populism is a dirty word nowadays, and I don't think it always has been. I don't think it necessarily always should be. Populism is a response to the failure of elites to run the society in a correct way, right? Like Caesar, it doesn't matter if he's a tyrant or not. We don't spend any time with him. The point is that the society that produced him, the society where Brutus and Cassius are the avatars, like their fathers, their forefathers are always talking about, they are the society. They're not. I don't want them running. I don't want them running the place any more than Caesar does. And the way that they botched this coup in a really massive way, in not thinking about how the people are going to react to their favorite politician, their favorite hero, their champion, being taken down, there's a lot of foolhardiness, there's a lot of blindness, there's a lot of naivete on the part of the patricians in the play. And I think it's very easy for us to point to, go, Caesar was a tyrant, you know? But the assassination released more chaotic forces and energies which could not be predicted and which take over and subsume the elites who caused the problems in the first place. And I'm not going to connect that to the present day, but that's my answer to that.
Yeah, but the Romans recognized there was two ways to like get power in Rome. You could work through the traditional optimate, the upper class patrician way to get power, working through the Senate. And then there was another tradition of working through the people. And Caesar did that. His family was associated with Marius, you might know, who was a big populist in around 100 BC. And he worked that way. And so he was really down with the people, and he used the people to get power. So
And it's a historical process, right?
Right.
Caesar's not the first demagogue of Rome.
No,
he's
no,
the last
no.
in a long line.
Right.
Of them.
He's the most. He is the most successful demagogue, the most successful politician ever Rome ever produced, because he's able to manipulate and take over. But then he wasn't smart enough to keep himself from being killed. So,
yeah. What about the idea that if Caesar hadn't been assassinated by the patricians, that the Republic would have at least lingered another 50 or 100 years before it became an empire?
I mean, the big thing is you just don't know what would happen. I mean, he was going to only stay in Rome for a couple more months, from what I understand, and then go off and fight a war against the Parthians. He wanted to go out and win more military glory. And I think being out in the field, being a military general, is a lot easier for him than being home with all his friends, you know, and all the problems there in Rome. He wanted to fix things, but I think he wanted to get out, go to the East, and then see what happens.
Mm-hmm. And I say, what's really the difference between one slave trading, murdering society, war-making society run by a Senate, and one run by an empire? What's really the difference?
An oligarchy or an autocracy, right? Mm-hmm. One other thing for context before we come to an end, and that is, a lot of people don't have an idea how big the society was, what the population of the Roman Republic was at its end. And you've said before that they killed millions of people during these wars. So how many millions of people were there in the Roman Republic? Does anybody know? I mean, there are a lot of guesses, but you know, some people guess. For example, the city of Rome in the year zero. Some people say 100,000 or something like that, but other people say more than a million. So what's the background? Does anybody know?
I mean, I'd split it. I mean, the Circus Maximus, you know, which is the big, where they'd have the chariot races in Rome and do other events and festivals there. I mean, they could hold, I mean, there's different estimates. Some people say like 400,000, 200,000. So if you're trying to get, you know, most of the people in there, at least half, it's say 200,000. So at the low end, I'd say probably like 400,000. Half a million living in Rome. And then, I mean, I'm not, if I was going to take a guess, I'd say like 50 to 70 million or so. I mean, spread throughout. I mean, just the density was not there. Yeah. Right.
But the current European population is 400 or 500 million. So it took a long time for Europe to come back, like maybe until 1900 or 1800 or something like that, before it got back to the population that it was under Rome, right? Something like that.
Yeah, but also you have to. There's the Black Death and all these right. other yeah. horrible diseases there were coming in, and so
getting in the way.
Yeah.
Besides war. Okay, so there's time for one or two more questions. Anybody? Yeah, I see two. Okay,
great. I'd like to ask a question about the actual text. Besides the big moments, the big murders, are there things that we should look for, or are there certain characters that maybe aren't forefront that are pivotal to progressing the action, or that have those special Shakespearean moments where we say them in daily life and don't even realize that's where it came from?
Hmm. I'm glad you asked that, because I actually just wanted to ask a question of Richard. That when we spoke a little while ago, a couple months ago now, you hadn't read the play in a while. You hadn't spent time with it recently. And
right.
then you did again
yes.
in advance of this conversation and our conversations. And I guess it's connected, because I'm curious, like, what stood out to you when you had a little bit of distance from it and read it again. And if there are, you know, if there are characters or moments in the play that this, remind me your name. What's your Karen? That Karen is asking about in terms of characters, and you were speaking before about the way in which you know, we don't have one hero, and that everyone has these very influential
yes.
roles.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Gender in this production, Caesar is a woman. Now there's a. Brutus has a wife. Caesar has a wife, but they're sort of neglected and on the sidelines. And basically, it's a male society that we're looking at. And it turns out that this Shakespeare is very odd in the way he holds his fire and just slowly builds things up. You have a relationship between Brutus and Cassius, which is very puzzling. It seems like on sometimes a question of manipulation, one manipulating the other, Cassius particularly skillful, Brutus less so for the most part. So, but then they sort of, it turns out that they had a kind of lover's quarrel. And the women don't seem to carry much weight, and they know they're rather neglected. And you have Portia, Brutus's wife, is very articulate in observing the way her husband has detached herself from him. And so, you begin to wonder whether there's some imbalance when the woman Portia had been able to have what we would now call companionate marriage with Brutus, but it's broken down, and he leaves her bed and doesn't make love to her anymore, and she feels neglected. And meanwhile, there's this ultra close relationship between Brutus and Cassius, and so there's a lover's quarrel, and it goes on and on. That Shakespeare turns out to be more interested in that than we saw. So I would say, reading it now, in the collapse of this society, Shakespeare is pointing a finger opens up for certain periods, and it's a very powerful focus in the play. This friendship or whatever it is between Brutus and Cassius, it's a love that cannot quite speak its name. It doesn't, well, Shakespeare doesn't, for whatever reasons, and it's frequent in Shakespeare's career, that he leaves it a little bit hidden, so that many, many decades have not, of criticism of scholars and of actors, haven't given prominence to these things. But the more you see in it, you took a look at Portia, she's critiqued the whole business with her husband, and she just doesn't know what she's beside herself. She doesn't know what to do. So there's a kind of, you can picture the tragedy as partly a tragedy of disharmony in the soul, into individuals, and that's partly from a breakdown of, say, patterns of friendship and patterns of romance. It's a very, very poignant part of, and Shakespeare, I think, was very alert to this. He wanted to bring it out. He wanted to put it in his plays, even though it's very unusual and intimate, the emotions that are involved.
And in our production, Portia is certainly someone to watch. There are other layers going on with the women in our adaptation, because while they're often hidden, and in fact, a few months ago, we did a production called Roman Women, which was an adaptation of Caesar, staged at the Palace of Fine Arts. And that production was inspired because when reading Caesar and just beginning to think about the adaptation, it's like, where are they? There's two women. They both speak twice. We're pretty sure there were more women in Rome having more thoughts and feelings than that. And both of the times they speak in the original play, they're talking about how they're not being listened to. So Roman Women really grew out of an interest of, where are the women and what are they saying? You could make a play about where are the slaves and what are they doing? Except they have zero voice. Like, we don't, you know, we don't have them at all. So that's one of the things that both working with Shakespeare and working with, as you were asking about, its collision with our present moment and what's interesting right now and how to use Shakespeare to excavate that, is one of the things that we get to do when we're adapting these works and kind of excavate those hidden lives. So while this play, this adaptation, Caesar Maximus, is very male-centric and lots more straight lines than circular rotations that we had in the rotunda of the Palace of Fine Arts, we're really interested in the women and what they're doing offstage and what they're seeing and what they're hearing and what they're feeling. And they might get to have other stories going on. So pay attention to them.
All right, one last question.
I was going to ask a question, but I think both of you may have already answered it. This isn't a question, but did you consider, obviously you have, that hell has no fury like a woman in a man's role?
Sounds Shakespearean.
That's
a lot of fury.
Yeah.
I think with our casting of a woman as Caesar and with
very little time left, I am like, ooh, how to crack into the whole conversation about Caesar as a woman. But one thing I'll say that came up earlier about exploration of gender in these roles is that the way we're exploring it, and there are many ways that we could explore it, but the way that we're exploring it is that she is very much taking on a male attitude and persona. She's not... yes, so she's doing that, and that Calpurnia, in contrast, is this kind of hyper-feminized role as a sort of contrast. But we also really see her as this gender outlaw, and that it's so much about her, the things that you were speaking to, you know, charisma and power and all of these other skills that can be in a man or a woman, mm-hmm. That she is, and as you were saying, this constant as a northern star, I'm the only one in the firmament, that there's something singular about this person. So I think, yes, we're very much exploring this gendered perspective of what is it, and it is really intense. We worked on the assassination today to watch a bunch of men tear this woman apart. Is pretty interesting. And I think that this human has tremendous power. And she just happens to be a woman. But yeah, it's a really interesting thing to explore. And we're, as Nick was speaking to earlier, things are still emerging. So I think, yes, we have a very strong idea coming in. And now we get to find out how this actor and this ensemble sort of fully inhabits this choice that we've set in motion.
Almost as if you're saying that Cleopatra out-manipulated Julius Caesar and took over.
She might have.
She got awfully close.
She got Anthony again.
Yeah, she.
And that is historical. So, thank you very much. That was excellent. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.